You know, we're not cheerleaders, which I think is a mistake a lot of people make, that, you know, we're there to glory the team's good points and ignore the bad points. That's not how journalism works, certainly not these days when everything is under such microscopic inspection. I'm sure rugby journalists all over Britain would agree with me about there's far too much interference by press officers. We tend to call them, with good reason, prevention officers. Yeah, there were always really colourful people to write about. I mean, probably the most colourful of all springing to mind would be Bobby Windsor, who used to say things to me. He said, "Why haven't you reported that?" I said, "Well, because there's such a thing as the law of libel." And he said, "But it's true."
Hello and welcome to the Forward Pass podcast. My name is Graham Jenkins, and the latest media veteran to join me to look back on their career covering rugby union is Peter Jackson. We chatted on the eve of this year's Six Nations about his journalism journey, what he has learned along the way, and the colourful characters he has encountered. I hope you enjoy what he has to say, and don't forget the full Forward Pass podcast archive, including my conversations with Stephen Jones, Nick Mullins, and Sonia McLaughlin, is available via iTunes. Joining me today is veteran rugby journalist Peter Jackson, who's been writing about the sport for over 50 years, I'm sure now, with the majority of that time spent as the Daily Mail's rugby correspondent. He retired from that role in 2009, but continues to break news and offer views for the rugby paper, and recently earned some TV fame on BBC Wales' Scrum 5 magazine show. A noted author as well as a highly respected journalist, Peter has kindly agreed to join me and reflect on his long and varied career. Hi, Peter, and thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction, Graham.
Okay, Peter, what came first? Was it the passion for the rugby or a passion for writing?
No, it was a passion for writing. I was blessed in that I always had a clear idea of what I wanted to do in life. From probably about the age of 11 or 12, I wanted to be a sports journalist. I grew up in the 50s when newspapers were king. Local radio hadn't been thought of. Mobile phones, you know, if you talked about anything like that, you'd have been taken away by men in white coats and locked up. So it was very much a newspaper-dominated age, the 50s. You followed all the major sporting events through the eyes of the great reporters of the time. I remember I was lucky enough once to win a prize at school, and we could pick a book. And I remember mine was More Ringside Seats by Peter Wilson, whose Big Sports on the Mirror, and the Mirror were then, I think, the highest selling newspaper in Europe, with something close on 6 million. And Peter Wilson was the expert primarily on boxing, but he did a lot of rugby as well. But growing up in Northern Ireland was an experience, because everything in life seemed to be dictated by religion. If you were Protestant and you were lucky enough to pass the 11 plus, then you went to grammar school where rugby was played, soccer was not. If you failed your 11 plus, then you went to secondary modern where there was no rugby, but there was soccer. Likewise, for the Catholic boys, you went to their grammar schools where naturally Irish sports held the sway, Gaelic football, hurling, etc. So there were two very different kinds of society growing up. I mean, I was very lucky. My parents were very liberal. They allowed me to do what I liked on a Sunday. And so, I had some wonderful Catholic friends, and we used to play a bit of Gaelic football as well. And it was only I only became aware of rugby when I went to the grammar school. And it was fascinating looking back. I remember sitting in what they very grandly called the gymnasium. It was a bit Spartan by the standards of today, but back then it was par for the course. And we were sat down, we were given our basic sort of introduction to rudimentary rugby and the laws of the game. And, of course, as kids, you're always used to kind of kicking the ball forward more than backwards. And I remember the gym master saying, "Now, you know, unlike in soccer, there's no standing still in this game. It is a character builder." And everything was sort of anti-soccer. And it got to the stage where once, it was 1957, Northern Ireland, who had a pretty good football team in those days, people like the Blanchflower brothers and Jimmy McElroy and Billy Bingham, Harry Gregg, were on the verge of qualifying for the World Cup the following year in Sweden. And they played, they were due to play Italy in a crucial game at Windsor Park in Belfast on the Wednesday afternoon. Of course, in those days, no floodlighting. And I can recall, as though it was yesterday, standing in the assembly hall at Foyle College in my hometown, and the headmaster saying, if I catch any boy missing rugger this afternoon to watch the hired gladiators of soccer, he will answer to me in my study tomorrow morning. And the headmaster, Mr. Stuart Connolly, was a ferocious man. I will forever be in his debt because he gave me a passion for the English language, but he was not a man to be trifled with. So needless to say, we all dutifully turned up for our house rugby matches that afternoon while wondering what on earth was happening in Belfast. And it's like anything else in life. If somebody tells you often enough that, look, this is a bad thing, this soccer, you kind of think, ooh, maybe we should try that. And rugby then wasn't cool because rugby was seen in Northern Ireland as a bit of a class game, pursued by the kids who went to the posher schools. And I don't think that was inaccurate. And the only time I think the working man ever really talked about the Ireland rugby team was if they played what would then have been a Five Nations game, and there might have been a cursory sort of, oh, I see we lost to England or whatever. It never grabbed the imagination. And it was only, Graham, when I went to Cardiff and changed jobs that my whole life changed. And then I couldn't believe it that bus conductors were talking about football, and by football they meant rugby. Mm-hmm. And all the little grounds in South Wales, across Keys, Newbridge, all these, they all had floodlights. And it was there that I felt the passion for the game. And in many ways, I wish I'd felt that when I was back home as a kid growing up in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to sort of the first steps of your career, is it right you came across Mike Gibson in your schoolboy playing days?
Yes, I did. I mean, I started off doing sort of reports on Derry City Football Club for my local paper, the weekly paper, the Derry Standard, which has long since gone to the great newspaper office in the sky. And the headmaster at the school, he didn't exactly frown upon it, but he called me in one day and he said, Jackson, he said, why don't you write about the first 15? And I said, well, sir, I'm trying to get into the first 15. He said, I know that, but he said the seconds play just before the first, so you'll be changed and ready and write a piece about the first. So of course, I was in no position to refuse. I wrote the piece. His secretary then called me in when the piece appeared in the paper the following Tuesday, and he had a copy in front of him, and I thought, oh, my goodness, what have I done now? And he said, well, Jackson, I can't fault the grammar. He said, I think you've been a bit harsh on Moore. Richard Moore, the late Richard Moore, died recently, was on the right wing for the school, and twice he was put clear, and twice poor old Richie fumbled the ball. And I said, well, sir, that's what happened. Yes, but Jackson, you're there to encourage the boys. So right from the beginning, I was almost getting a rollicking for not encouraging enough. And,
yeah.
And so it continued. But shortly after that, I got called back into his office to say, look, the teams for the weekend haven't gone up yet, Jackson, but we've been having a bit of a grim time, and we're going to play you at half. And I had no great ambitions as a rugby player. I was dreadfully limited. I was, you know, if my inside centre saw the ball three times over the course of a season, then that was probably about it. Because our hero was Jack Kyle, and Jack used to work the touchlines like magic, and we all thought we could do the same. Anyway, he said, look, good luck on Saturday. And he said, don't worry about this chap Gibson, as I was going out the door. And I never heard of Gibson, but there was a guy in my class who knew all about all the rugby players at all the schools. And I said, who's this Gibson? Oh, he said, that's Mike Gibson. He said, he's the biggest thing since sliced bread. He said, you're not playing Saturday, are you? I said, yes. Oh, what have you done to deserve that? Gibson will be playing. And, of course, you know, Gibson then became what the late John Reason described as pound for pound, the greatest three-quarter that the British Isles has produced, you know, for the last 50 years of the amateur era. So, yes, that was my misfortune. To say I suffered by comparison would be, to put it mildly. But it kind of reinforced my view. If you're going to make a living out of sport, it's going to be writing about it and not playing it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Derry paper there, and then obviously the move to South Wales. What were the steps in that sort of process?
Well, I was lucky. I was selected to go on a National Union of Journalists training course at Swansea University in August of 64, which was a week-long session. And Stupid Oakback and I objected to going because it was the start of the soccer season back home and all kinds of things were happening. And they said, look, you've been very privileged to be selected, go and you'll learn a lot. And meeting sort of colleagues from all over the country, in Scotland, England, excuse me, and Wales, It was a wonderful learning experience. And the editor of the South Wales Echo, Jeff Rich, offered me a job in Cardiff, and I said, well, that's very flattering. I said, I want to be a sports reporter. And he said, no, he said, they're 10 a penny. He said, you'll be a news reporter, and with a bit of luck, you might be a decent one. And, of course, my mother was from Wales. My grandparents lived just outside Brecon. So it was, if not quite a home from home, it was a sort of place that I had always thought I might gravitate to. And so, yes, that was probably the move that did change my life. I mean, that was 1964. It was just before all the troubles began in Northern Ireland. And, you know, you could see them coming from quite a long way off. But, you know, my reason for leaving was not to avoid those. That was purely fortuitous. Mm-hmm. It was to further my career professionally because there were such limited opportunities in Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Was there a spell at the Belfast Telegraph, or have I read that wrong?
Yeah, I was at the... I mean, when I left school, I was studying to go to university, and I joined the Belfast Telegraph in my hometown as a news reporter. I didn't have a clue as to how to write a news story, but there were some very good people there. John Dinsmore, the news editor, you know, I couldn't have wished to have learnt from better qualified, more patient people. John Wallace was the chief reporter who later became political correspondent of the Belfast Telegraph and the Irish Press. And, you know, these were momentous times when, you know, the country was in turmoil and all kinds of political figures like Ian Paisley and Lord Fitz and Gerry Adams, all kinds of people were striding across the state. So I learned immensely from them. I just went through the usual bits, you know, courts, inquests, fires. I remember that the ritual we had was we were never allowed to leave until after the Northern Ireland news, which appeared on the long service of the radio at, I think, 6:15 on an evening, and it lasted for 10 minutes. And there would always be on a Monday when I'd arranged to take my girlfriend to the pictures, because in my hometown everybody went to the pictures on the Monday night, there was nothing else to do. There'd be a report. Oh, reports were just coming in of a German trawler in trouble off the Donegal coast. Rescue services are on their way. And John Dinsmore would look at me and say, what are you doing tonight, Peter? And I said, well, I'm supposed to go to the pictures. Not now, you're not. He said, get off to Donegal and find out about that German trawler. And it didn't do much for my social life, but it was great fun. I mean, driving down there trying to speak to the people who'd been rescued, and it just gave me a feeling of excitement and the sense that you were actually sort of telling the readers something that had happened on their doorstep and that they might be interested in. So I was very grateful that I had that grounding.
Mm-hmm. And so you were a news reporter initially at the South Wales Echo as well?
Yes, I was. I did that not for very long, I think just for less than a year. I wanted to get into sport. By then, I shared digs with a chap called Hugh Jones, who became a sports producer on BBC, who was from West Wales. He was a student at the College of Music and Drama. He was big into rugby. And to while away the time, we devised a game, a card game, where we'd split the top 16 teams in Wales. He had eight, I had eight, and we worked out a method of scoring by using a pack of cards and my teams would play his teams. And even then, I used to say to Hugh, you know, there'd be more interest in rugby if they organised themselves into proper leagues, and you know, you had promotion and relegation, and create more excitement. And it was surprising that I think that still took the best part of another quarter of a century before that came to pass. So yes, the job that came up was as the chief soccer writer, which again was interesting in that it got you round about the country. It taught you the basics of how to try to get on with people or not get on with people, and there were some pretty fearsome characters. Going with it was the Welsh national team, so you had a fair bit of travel. And it was only some years later when I was in Spain on a family holiday. The kids were very young, and bought the Daily Mail, and I read two paragraphs of the death of Mervyn Thomas, who Mervyn was an outstanding Daily Mail journalist. He was a former Wales youth international from Pontypool, and Mervyn had died suddenly from a heart attack, mowing his lawn. And when I got back, people said to me, you should put in for that job. And I said, well, you know, I mean, I don't know people in rugby, that's my problem. And they said, put in for the job, and I did, and I got it. And again, it was as if somebody was being very kind to me, because that coincided with the great 70s era. I mean, I started in 1974. My first match for the Mail was Wales against the All Blacks, a midweek Wednesday afternoon game at Cardiff Arms Park. And so gradually, I immersed myself in rugby to the point where it overtook everything else. And round about that time, terrible things were happening in football, Heysel and Hillsborough. And I was actually offered by the Mail. They said, look, have you thought about terms of being the chief soccer correspondent? I said, well, you know, it's very flattering of you to suggest it. I said, I'd much sooner be the chief rugby correspondent if and when that job becomes available. And they said, oh, yes, we understand that. And the reasons for that were that I enjoyed rugby more. Rugby, to me, then was full of colourful characters, which is something I regret about the game today, in that, you know, it's all become a bit like football. You know, you leave school, you join an academy, You become pretty one-dimensional. But you know, I go back to the great days of the 70s with Wales. You had steel workers and miners rubbing shoulders with doctors and lawyers, and you know, that they were all interesting people, and they were all quite willing to speak their mind on things. But of course, you know, the game was just that. It was a game. It wasn't their livelihood, although some of them felt it ought to have been. There were always really colourful people to write about. I mean, probably the most colourful of them all, springing to mind, would be Bobby Windsor, who used to say things to me. He said, why haven't you reported that? I said, Bob, because there's such a thing as the law of libel. And he said, but it's true. And I said, well, I've no doubt it is true, but we have a saying in journalism as well, which says the bigger the truth, the bigger the libel. So, yes, I really sort of loved those blokes, and it kind of spoiled me for a lot of things. And then I was even more blessed when I did become the chief rugby correspondent of the Mail, because that coincided with that long sort of period leading up to the advent of professionalism, and all kinds of things were going on in the game. You may well recall David Lord, who was the Australian entrepreneur, who again was ahead of his time in terms of talking about buying up the players and setting up a circus. And he had the players, but he didn't really have the money. And that sort of galvanized the unions into doing something about it. But of course, we all knew that for a long, long time, players, particularly in France and South Africa, were being paid, and that amateur rugby union was a sham. Mm.
You know, you spent 35 years with the Mail in total. I guess the, like you say, the colourful characters helped sort of maintain that enthusiasm. But at the same time, how was working in that rugby pack for that time?
Wonderful. You know, I couldn't have wished for better colleagues to have worked with and against, because, you know, we were competing against each other. But we did that in a way without falling out. Well, you know, inevitably there were bust-ups, but they didn't last very long. They accepted it, that we were all trying to scoop each other, I suppose. But on tour, there tended to be more of a sort of communal effort. Nobody wanted to be woken up in Dunedin by an irate news desk saying, why haven't we got this story in the Telegraph, or what about this piece in the Times? Because newspapers, I mean, certainly the Mail, I mean, the Mail has long had a justifiable reputation as the kind of journalist paper, the most professional operation. One of the downsides of that, of course, is that they do demand their pound of flesh, and the worst call to get is obviously the one after midnight, because more often than not, that means that you know, something has appeared in one of the papers. I'll give you a funny example. Mm-hmm. Once I got a call about 12:15 from the Mail news desk. Look, there's a story on the back page of the Mirror. I said, oh yes. It says that Sven-Goran Eriksson, who was then the England football manager, had invited Clive Woodward to address the England football team before they had a game the following week. And I said, oh, that's not bad, is it? Yeah, no, we missed that one. I said, whose name is on it? Thinking it might have been Alex Fink, who was the rugby man. And it wasn't Alex's name, and it sounded to me a bit like a cod name. And then they said that Nancy DeLolio had been quoted in the story. And I thought, hang on a minute, that sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? And I said, look, leave it with me, I'll make some inquiries. And of course, at 12:15, there aren't too many people you can start ringing, and you think, well, it's not really worth it. And then it suddenly dawned on me, and I rang the desk back, and I said, what's today? It's April the 1st. And it was rather a clever sort of mirror April Fool's story. So I was able then to go back to sleep thinking, ah, no, well, for once I haven't been scooped.
In terms of your fondest memories, perhaps fondest tours or fondest matches, is there any that spring to mind?
Yes, unquestionably, I thought the 1997 Lions tour, if only every Lions tour could have been like the 97 one. Why? Because it still had the best of the amateur ethos mingled in with early professionalism. Everybody was made welcome. It hadn't become by then the circus that it is now. There weren't people to stop you at every turn saying, you can't speak to him, you can't ask him that. You know, Fran Cotton was the manager. Fran, I think, in every sense, a gigantic figure in the game, not just in England. But he was free and easy, understood we had a job to do. And Ian McGeachan, the coach, likewise, always very accommodating. And, of course, they won the series. when I look back at it, I sometimes have to pinch myself, because if you look up the record of those three test matches, the try count was 10-3, I think, in favour of the Springboks. And, of course, they, in their arrogance, they believed that they didn't really have to have a goal kicker because they would score enough tries. And it's incredible to think only 20 years ago that a national team would disregard goal kicking to such an extent. The Lions are, on the contrary, knew exactly the value of goal kickers, to the point where they fitted one in, Neil Jenkins, out of position at fullback. And Neil, bless him, kicked all the goals. And the Springboks, I think, Andre Hubert was their fullback, and he was very hit and miss, and so were others. And glory be, the Lions won the series 2-1. So that had everything. I thought that was the most enjoyable time. And, of course, South Africa, essentially the same time zone as the UK, so you weren't working a 24-hour clock, as you tend to do in Australia and New Zealand. The matches were wonderful. Everywhere we went, you know, you were aware that it was a big event. People were hugely interested in it. And so for me, that will always be the standout tour, 97 South Africa.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you've also seen the World Cup grow and grow from sort of early beginnings into the massive extravaganza it is today.
Yes, I mean, I'm probably one of the very few now who's been to all the World Cups. I went out in 87. I'd never been to New Zealand, and which is where it began. Terry O'Connor was then the Mail's main man, was with England in Australia. And I just wondered, I was very excited about going to this huge event, rugby in New Zealand. And I was very disappointed at how low-key it all was. You know, there didn't seem to be any great bunting down the main drag in Auckland. I went to the first game. I think there were only six British journalists at that game. It was New Zealand against Italy at Eden Park. And again, there were some wonderful stories about that World Cup. I mean, John Gallagher, who came from Lewisham in South London, parents were Irish, and John had gone out to Wellington, I think only about 15 months before, as a transfer from the Met Police to the New Zealand Police, and had impressed to such an extent that he went on the fastest of tracks into an all-black team that was from a different planet, a bit like now, really, but perhaps even more so then. And I can remember the great Brian Lahore being the manager, and every game they'd win by a landslide, and he would always say, "We got lots to work on for the next game." And I'm thinking, good grief, if they've got lots to work on for the next game, what about the rest of us? And the only team I thought that came anywhere close to them along the way was Scotland in the quarter-final in Christchurch. They lost in the end by 30 points to 3, but it was a very poor reflection of how well Scotland had played that day. That was Scotland of the Hastings brothers and Colin Deans and those people. And wonderful memories from that first World Cup. But I probably wouldn't have thought then that it would grow into the monumental event that it's become. And of course, then 91, England-Australia. And again, it's fascinating to look back and think that the coach then, Roger Attlee, you know, went from that Saturday night, the after World Cup final dinner, back to his day job on Monday morning at Harrow School. And the following week, he was on the touchline. I went to do a piece with him. Harrow were playing, I can't remember their opponents, but, you know, that was the contrast, because it was still an amateur game. Mm-hmm. But by then, as you well know, the amateur days were numbered.
Yeah. I remember talking to you previously about a 95 World Cup, and I was lucky enough to sit next to you for the Lions tour in 2009, and you were telling me once again about the plane flying over ahead of the final that day.
That was staggering. They did tell us there was going to be a surprise, and all I can remember was the stands at the far end of the opposite side of Ellis Park to where we were, to the press box, where the players came out. So the ones began to vibrate. I thought, what's happening? And we heard this almighty roar. And then you saw the 747. And at first glance, it seemed to have sort of just climbed above the stands by about 20 feet. I mean, I'm sure that wasn't the case, but that was the sort of optical illusion. And it was a staggering sort of thing to do. I mean, there was one more recently, I think, before a Stade Francais game, during the days of the flamboyant Max Guazzini when he was running them. I think they had a pair of Falcons, wasn't it, who came down to deliver the rugby balls on the halfway line. But this was breathtaking. I mean, it took endless practice to get it right, and it was daring. But I mean, I think of all the events I was at, in terms of one of global dimension, then that final, it was, I mean, it wasn't a great final in a game of rugby, but it was a wonderful climax, extra time. But then, you know, Nelson Mandela dancing in his Springbok jersey with Francois Pienaar, sort of changed South Africa. And he, you think, a man who's been incarcerated for 27 years, comes out without a bone, sort of trace of bitterness in his bones, and sets about sort of leading this country, I just thought it was absolutely amazing. And maybe, who knows, maybe Nelson had contacts in higher places, but you wouldn't really have given the Springboks a prayer of winning that game going into it. And of course, All Blacks will be very quick to tell you that Susie the waitress poisoned them, and that was the reason they lost the game. I mean, it's a nice story that sort of people come out and let loose every so often, but the fact is it's in the book, 15-12, Joel Stransky drop goal.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your exchanges with Bobby Windsor. Are there any other particular players or coaches you made a beeline for, knowing they would be great copy?
Yes, I mean, all those Welsh players, they were always very available. I mean, Barry John, the prototype rugby superstar, Barry would say, you ring me any time you want, you know, it's never a problem. And it never was with him. I probably had, I wish I could have said, but I'd gone on with certain England players as well as I'd gone on with those fellas. I mean, Will Carling, great admiration for him as a player. When the chips were down, boy, did he stand up. And, you know, Will got a lot of criticism about the Lions in New Zealand in 93. But when the Lions hit probably rock bottom at Hamilton, when a Waikato team that included John Mitchell and Warren Gatland and all those people beat the Lions 38-6. Carling, I can still see now, manning the barricades when others weren't bothered. And that game brings to mind another story that in the clubhouse afterwards, a couple of elderly Welsh fans, because nobody supports the Lions like the Welsh, they turn up in greater numbers than the Irish, English or Scottish. And there was one fella, and he went up to Andy Reid, the Scotland second row, and he said, you know, boy, he said, I've spent a lot of money to come out here, and, you know, I'm really disappointed with today. I mean, you're the British Lions, and I expected a lot better than that. And Andy, and maybe in hindsight, he probably might have wished he'd apologised to him, but, you know, one argument led to another, and then there were some suggestions that they were going to finish the argument outside. And Mike Teague was sipping beer within earshot, and he said, my money's on the old fella. So that just kind of shows you the emotions that are stirred up by the Lions. But to get back to Carling, I mean, I 94 England tour of South Africa, I wrote a piece which was critical of him. He thought it was unfair. Normally, when people have an issue, you know, you go straight to them and say, come on, you know, what's this about? You know, why have you said this? Don't you know that? Et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I made strenuous efforts to try to reach him to say, well, what's the problem, Will? And I then discovered, rather uncomfortably, that I'd been sent to Coventry on that tour. And so people who were normally more than happy to pass the time of day with me, people like lovely lads like Steve and Jomo, were saying, Jacko, don't, you're going to get me fined. So I think there was a fine for anybody who was seen talking to me. And some while later, Victor Ubogo, in a column in The Observer, made some reference to it and said it was a very childish prank orchestrated by Carling. But I'm sure that Rob Andrew and Brian Moore were involved as well. I mean, that was disappointing, and it was difficult because, you know, when all's said and done, you're talking about a bloke's ability here to do his job in a competitive business. And months later, Carling did come to me and said, look, I'm sorry about that. I said, well, look, I made every effort to speak to you at the time. But there we go. I don't suppose you can get on with everybody in life.
Yeah, I was going to say, even in the pre-social media age, I understand readers would put pen to paper to take you to task about certain things.
Yes, they did. I mean, it used to be an old story in journalism, well, you know, if you're not annoying them, you're not doing your job. In other words, our job, when all stripped away, is to put out, tell the public things that about people whom the public would rather they didn't know. And I remember on one day, I must have of excel myself, because I went into the mail office in Kensington and caught up with the post, and there were one letter accusing me of being an anti-English so-and-so, and then on the same day there was a similar letter accusing me of being an anti-Welsh so-and-so. And I always used to say to people, it doesn't matter where I come from, you know. And Dudley Wood, the very urbane RFU secretary, used to make a point. I mean, in a nice way, because Dudley was a nice man, say, oh, you know, all these Welsh blokes are writing about rugby, and how many English have we got? We've got a couple of Irish, you know. Almost the inference being that, well, if you're not English, you're not going to be pro the England rugby team. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, your job as the rugby correspondent is to write about the team. You're writing primarily for your readership, not for the players, because they're the people who buy the paper. Yes, you're more than happy to give, you know, England, Wales, whoever the main team is, the benefit of a doubt, but that doesn't stop you. You know, we're not cheerleaders, which I think is a mistake a lot of people make, that, you know, we're there to glory the team's good points and ignore the bad points. That's not how journalism works, certainly not these days when everything is under such microscopic inspection.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned you stepped down from the Daily Mail, obviously, in 2009, but, you know, there's no sense of complete retirement. You continue to work today for the rugby paper. How does that working week work for you now?
Well, David Emery rang me up and asked me if I'd do that, and which was very kind of him. And I said, well, David, you know, I've kind of been chasing around all over the place for the last 40-odd years. No, he said, well, it won't be like that. He said, just write a column on what appeals to you. And so he's basically just thinking round about the beginning of the week, well, what am I going to do? What topic am I going to think of for the weekend? I don't like to make up my mind too early. I certainly want to know by Thursday. But if you make up your mind too early, then, you know, 48 hours is a long time in rugby, and things change, things happen, something gives you the idea of a piece. I mean, I did a piece last week about Big Badger Mills, the former Great Britain and Bradford Northern rugby league player, and I've known Jim for a long time. And I wrote a piece once about him in the Mail, about how he had been sent off more often than any player in rugby history. And there was a call the next day. I was in the office, a colleague picked up, he said, it's for you, it's Jim Mills. And my heart sank, because it wasn't probably the most flattering of pieces. So I picked up the phone with some trepidation, and I said, hello, Jim. He said, look, son. And again, my heart went even further down, and he said, you have to get your facts right. You said, I've been sent off 21 times. He said, get it right, it was 22. And so we had a bit of a laugh about that, but yeah, Jim's a great character. You never lose sight of these people. And I think also it's good maybe to remind the young generation that these guys were around, and these were the sort of things they did. This was how different the game was back then. I certainly don't want people to think I'm living in a time warp or anything, but, you know, I mean, we've got the Six Nations coming up. Bonus points are obviously going to be a talking point. What difference it makes remains to be seen, because, you know, people say, oh, well, it'll give the losing team an added incentive to score tries. But hang on, you know, you're playing for your country. What more incentive do you need to score tries than that? So we'll see how it works out. Certainly over the last 10 years, I don't think there was any one season when bonus points would have made that big a difference. Although there was one year, I think maybe 2002, or before that, the season that was disrupted by the foot and mouth epidemic, when England were going great guns, and then games were held over until the following autumn. It was either that year that England lost one but won the other four. They would have had more points than France did at the Grand Slam, and clearly that was wrong, but they built in that safety device, haven't they, that a Grand Slam winner will get extra points anyway. So, you know, the Grand Slam team will always still finish first.
Mm-hmm. Looking generally at the sport, do you think it's in good shape? You know, there's a... obviously, most recently, there's the tackle directives that are causing some concern amongst supporters and players. But in general, do you think the sport has come a long way?
I think to say it's come a long way is an understatement. I remember Wasps at Repton Avenue. I remember Wasps at Loftus Road. Wasps at Wickham at the end of that bottleneck going into the industrial estate on a day when, you know, 6,000 would be a good crowd. And I look at them now, 28,000 people against Leicester. Staggering. Wonderful, wonderful story, you know, from being almost going out of business to now being like the Pied Pipers of the West Midlands and perhaps filling the void that, you know, in a perfect world, great amateur clubs like Coventry would have filled. So, I mean, who would have forecast that? I remember Sid Miller, for whom, you know, immense respect, you know, he's propping for Ireland when I saw my first international in 1959. And he saying to me a long, long time ago, he said, always remember one thing. The public will only come out in big numbers for international rugby. They won't support the club rugby to the same extent. Now, whether that was wishful thinking from Sid's part, who didn't want to see the club game maybe grow too big, well, for whatever reason, I mean, that's totally wrong. It's astonishing. You look at Bordeaux in France, they're averaging almost 25,000. And yet, they're barely in the top six teams in the country. Leicester, not that, well, maybe 40 years ago, were averaging about 3,000. Then they filled the old Welford Road. They keep extending it. They keep filling it. It's wonderful. I mean, Leicester Tigers, almost as well supported as Leicester City. Not quite, but almost, you know. And those were things that, I remember 1991, a soccer reporter saying to me at the end of the World Cup, which had commanded great space in the papers, rightly so, and he said, well, there you go, back to your two men and a dog down in Bath. And I said, hey, Bath averaged 10,000 people. That's probably more than a lot of football clubs do on a Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, I'm amazed in one sense, but not in another, because when you see the pro game played as it deserves to be, you think, what a spectacle. Ireland against New Zealand and Chicago. I defy anybody who had not seen rugby before to say, look at that, and then say, boy, I didn't like that. I mean, it was just sport at its very best. Wonderful theatre, totally unexpected, great rugby. It wasn't as if Ireland sort of relied on penalty goals and had a lot of luck. It was the fact that Ireland took it to the All Blacks and said, we're going to out-try you. We're going to score 5 tries. You see if you can match that. You know, unheard of. I don't think any of the home countries have scored 5 tries against the All Blacks before. So when I see the game like that, I go back also to a European semi-final at Lansdowne Road on a Sunday, a glorious day. Wasps against Munster. Something like 35-32, I think Trevor Leota, you know, the Samoan hooker, won it with a try in the corner. Stupendous rugby. I mean, absolutely, you just couldn't beat it. And when I get the choice now to watch, say, a Champions Cup match over a live football match, it's no argument. I'll watch the Champions Cup match all the time. Having said that, yes, there are problems, and I'm concerned about the ease with which players are now can be sent off for simply trying to catch a high ball. And is it their fault if the opposing wing chooses to take a suicidal leap and come in over the top of him? You know, I think there's a difference between that and deliberately tipping somebody up when he's in the air. But, you know, I couldn't understand why the Bordeaux wing, for instance, was sent off recently against Exeter, when I thought all he did was keep his eyes on the box kick. And then the Exeter wing, I think it was Ollie Woodburn, came in over the top of him, and that, for the grace of God, didn't break his neck. But, you know, not only did Exeter get the penalty, they got the red card as well. I thought the Bordeaux wing didn't do anything wrong. Likewise, with the head-high tackle, it's all very well to say, right, no tackling above the shoulder. But players being players and coaches being coaches, they'll say, right, well, what you do here is you go in very low so that, you know, you're so low that if anybody's going to tackle you, they're bound to hit you around the head. So I would hope that referees would use their sense of feel for the game. It's tough for them because they've got split second, haven't they, to make up their minds. We can sit back, analyse it frame by frame almost, and say, oh yes, you know, we should have gone. But the danger now is you go from one extreme to the other. You go from back in the amateur era of allowing all kinds of skullduggery to happen and keep players on the field, to going off now, and I think there's a danger that we'll lose players to red cards unnecessarily. And the danger then is that you almost emasculate the game as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. Is there one particular thing about the game or that gripes or that you'd like to change if you had the power to?
Yeah, most definitely the one thing, and again, this is a kind of in-house thing that I'm sure rugby journalists all over Britain would agree with me about. There's far too much interference by press officers. We tend to call them, with good reason, prevention officers. I mean, there's one club, I don't know why, but, you know, if you ask to speak to a player there, they used to say, well, what do you want to talk to them about? Well, you know, about the season generally. Yeah, but could we have specific questions? Well, no. I mean, what do you want specific questions for? And I think that's unnecessary. I'd like to think if I was the press officer at a club, that A, I would take the job on the understanding that people would listen to my advice as to how we tackle things, and that when a player is suspended for gouging, as Dylan Hartley has been, that at some stage towards the end of that suspension, you say, right, Dylan, people are going to want to talk to you about this. We will organise a press conference, and you go out and you say what you think about the last 6 months and how much you've learned from it. A mea culpa, if you like. Everybody will go away. That will all be done in one fell swoop, and you won't be bothered with questions about it again. Northampton didn't confront the issue, so that it was then left until Hartley had returned to the England camp, and then it had to be dealt with. And I think a shining example to English rugby of how to, or British rugby, how to deal with things came from the Australian cricket team. A few years back, you may recall, David Warner had a dust-up with Joe Root in a club in Birmingham during the Edgbaston Test match, and the day after, I think a couple of the Sundays broke the story, the Australian management said, right, gentlemen, here's a press conference, and here's David Warner. And they put him up, and Warner said how much he'd let down the baggy green and how sorry he was. But it was over and done with. It didn't fester. And I wish that rugby clubs would grasp that and say, you know, whether we like it or not, we're in the entertainment business. These things happen. And this is why players are paid big money. And if you fall from grace, then I think you should front up in the same way that you front up to take the glory. And that's why I will have undying admiration for people who always did that. Charlie Hodgson was one. Martin Corrie another. More often than not, having to defend an England defeat. I mean, I think it was 7 or 8 in a row, which led to Andy Robinson's departure. And Richard Cockerell was another. Richard Cockerell always never ducked a question. You could ask Richard, I remember the 16th man episode at the Ospreys, Leicester Ospreys at Swansea, when Lee Byrne came back on the pitch before his replacement had gone back off. And it didn't really affect the game. It only lasted for about 30 seconds. But both Peter Wheeler and I think Peter Tom were saying, well, you know, this shouldn't happen, and it's a competition. You know, this is not good for the game. And there was a sort of feeling that maybe Leicester would exploit this and make an issue of it. And Cockerell was asked, well, what about the 16th man issue? And he said straight away, made no difference to the result whatsoever. Forget it. Next question. And that's why I admired Cockerell. And I admire people like him. And I wish the game had more. The game has a lot. And the game's in wonderful shape. I think it could be in even better shape.
Mm-hmm. Talking of strong opinions, Peter, while I have you, I must ask you about your crowd-pleasing turn on Scrum 5. How did that come about, and are readers and viewers likely to see you there again?
Well, it came about, Wales, I could not believe how bad Wales were against Australia in the first match of the November series. I racked my brain, because you don't want to overreact, and you say, have I seen anything as bad as this from Wales in Cardiff? And the answer was no, I had not. And they were so bad that the Wallabies ought to have scored 50 points in the first half alone. Now, inevitably, you know, you roll a little bit back in the second half because the game's gone. And 32-5. And I was disappointed at, or surprised at the reaction of Rob Howley. You know, as the interim coach, everybody wishes him well. But he sort of seemed a little bit mealy-mouthed about it. Well, we're traditionally slow starters. I'd like Tim to have said, what you saw today was unacceptable. We apologise to the fans. We rest assured we will bust even more of a gut next week to put it right. And everybody said, well, good on you, Rob. You've recognised it for what it was. Absolute rubbish. And things didn't improve that much. And a couple of weeks later, when Sam Davis got the late drop goal against Japan, Rob did say, we were lucky to win. The better team lost. And so you recognise that. But BBC Wales had been taking sort of sound bites of us in the stadium, and I'd been giving off a bit, particularly about the Wallaby game. And they invited me on the programme, and it was a bit daunting because they have about 120 fans there, so it's almost like you're going to a reality show or something. And I just felt that things needed to be said. I question whether Wales have got their priorities right in terms of providing the Lions with so many personnel. I mean, I know a lot of other countries have declined offers, at Townsend in Scotland, Joe Smith in Ireland, Jason O'Halloran in Scotland as well. But at a time when it's been made clear that Wales have become rather one-dimensional, perhaps you can make out a case that Warren Gatland should still be with Wales. I also made some pointed comments about the contract that he has, which is not a criticism of him at all. It's a criticism of the previous chief executive who gave him that contract, which I think requires him only to spend something like 120 days of each year in Wales. And I would say that Warren was, whether he still is post Eddie Jones, I don't know, the highest paid coach in the game. So I was annoyed at how poor Wales had been. I was annoyed as well at this sort of thing, oh, well, it'll be all right next week. Well, hang on. They'd been in camp for 2 weeks before the Wallaby game. I just felt very strongly about it. And the trouble, as you will know, Graham, in journalism, if you express your views, then you're liable to upset people, and then they don't speak to you, and, oh, that's the end of the corporation, I'm going to give him. Well, if that's the price I pay for my views, well, so be it. It was nice to know that the fans sort of generally tuned in with what I had to say, although there was one tweet which amused me. It was something about more rubbish from the lamentable Peter Jackson. How the Mail put up with him for so long, I do not know. I don't know who sent that one, but I'm probably more used to being criticised than praised anyway.
Okay, just to wrap things up, Peter, I don't expect you to remember, but you very kindly took a call from me during my student days 20-odd years ago now to offer some insight and some tips on how to make the grade in sports journalism. I just wonder if you could redo that again, really, for the next generation of reporters, writers. What tips would you give them to get on in this?
Enthusiasm. You know, when you get knocked back, when you're disappointed, bounce back up again. You know, don't feel sorry for yourself. You've got to develop a fairly hard skin. You'll feel disappointed. You'll feel, I could have done that. I could have done that better than the bloke who's done it. Well, yeah, then make sure that you're available the next time the opportunity comes along. Keep persevering. Don't be put off easily. The landscape of the job has changed an awful lot since my young days. Then you got interviews by simply walking up to a player and saying, excuse me, I'm Peter Jackson. Can I have a word with you about, you know, that try or that goal or whatever? And more often than not, they'd say, sure. So, again, be a good listener. My father always used to say, son, you learn nothing from the sound of your own voice. Listen to people, even when you're in interviews with and the person you're interviewing perhaps is being a little slow, he's looking for, or he or she is looking for the right words, don't interrupt. Just let them continue speaking, because that's the way you'll get the best quotes, you know, the most meaningful comments. Let them, the whole art of being an interviewer is like a good referee. You're not seen. Just ask the short, simple questions. And if you can, and it's very difficult, never ask a question really that can simply just be, well, when I say never, of course there are times when you've got to say, I want a straight answer, yes or no. But equally there are other times when, if somebody is a little bit reticent about speaking, then to ask them a question which they can't respond to with simply a yes or a no or a monosyllable, you know, that they would have to say, well, that's an interesting question and I would see it this way. And so you get them talking. There is an art to that. And if you're born with it, you're very lucky. Most of us have had to work at developing that, to know your subject. Always come briefed. Always know as much as you can about the person you're interviewing him, so that you will impress he or she with your knowledge of him. Don't ever sort of say to a bloke, how many times did you play for England? Because that will invite the answer, well, you should know that. It's a wonderful business to be in. I do worry these days about the lack of access and how you can actually develop relationships. I remember 2007, I think, England tour of South Africa, and a couple of the players were going home, and one of them was Peter Richards, the scrum half at London Irish, and we were working in a pub. We weren't drinking, but we'd been to a Springbok training or something. We happened to be in this place. They were at the bar. I went out, can I buy you lads a drink, because they were going home the next day. And they said, what are you doing today? I said, well, we're sitting doing a story on such and such. And they said, yeah, but there isn't a game till Saturday. And I said, no, but we do stuff every day. I said, God, I never knew that. And sadly, that's because now there is that divide between the critic and the performer, which I think is to the detriment of both. I think we'd have a better understanding if we could go back to the old days when we all mingled together as one, and if somebody wanted to ball you out, then they did so in front of all the players, but it was forgotten about. And I don't suppose those days will come back, but there's an awful lot worse ways of earning a living than being a sports journalist.
I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you for your insight and your time.
Okay, that's fine, Graham. Thank you.